Welcome to Act 3, the podcast where we explore how to thoughtfully shape the rest of our lives. I'm your host, Kara Gray. This podcast is sponsored by Good Morning Freedom, my retirement coaching service where I help executives and professionals plan their Act 3. For more information, stay tuned until the end. Today, I welcome Julie Danis to the podcast. Julie is a writer, storyteller, and former global marketing and advertising executive. Her career resembles a long and winding road with some twists, detours, and even dead ends. She studied social policy before going to business school, but after studying theater. She recently wrote and performed her solo show, Life's Too Short, and So Am I, at Chicago's Lifeline Theater 2024 Filet of Solo Festival. Other credits include writing for the award-winning documentary film, The Girl Who Wore Freedom, contributing essays to Fast Fallen Women, Fast Famous Women, and to Storytellers' True Stories About Love, Volume 1. As a business humorist, she wrote a Chicago Tribune column called It's a Living and contributed commentary to Public Radio's Marketplace Radio. She practiced humor on the job at places like Frito-Lay and Mondelez, the maker of Oreos, and in roles such as director of Mind and Mood at Foot, Cone, and Belding. Welcome, Julie, to the podcast.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. So recently, I had the pleasure of being in the audience when Julie performed her one-woman show, Life is Short, and So Am I. And in this show, she recounts her journey from early career to where she is today. Julie does not feel settled upon her third act, but is an excellent example of prototyping a lot of different options in search of identity and purpose and meaning in life. And I know we can all learn a lot from her journey, so I'm excited to have her here today. I always like to start by talking about what life looked like during the bulk of your career. And as we mentioned, there were twists and turns. So wherever you want to start, tell us about your career journey and maybe some of your proudest moments.
Well, the bulk of my career was in marketing and advertising. Mm-hmm. I did get a degree in social policy, a master's degree, but that was because I didn't really know what to do after college. And so I like school. I'm good at it. So I went to what seemed to be the right thing. I will say that I don't know that business was the right spot for me, my business school, but in the 80s, that's what women were doing if they didn't, if they wanted to do. Business schools were opening up to women, women were, I graduated in 77 from college, so women still weren't all, you know, getting out into the workforce, and it was very difficult. By the 80s, it was opening up, so I went into marketing and advertising, because to me, that sounded like the most fun part of business, and it is, in my mind, you know, more fun to market Frito-Lay potato chips and Oreo cookies than you know, cheer detergent, but it's still business down dirty. I realized that early on, I was much better in a service industry and working with people about creating something, especially something around communication, than working in a manufacturer and having to worry about how many chips we were selling and the whole bottom line. I was not excited about the profit and loss statements, which, you know, a business person should never admit. But when you're in the advertising agency, that's not, you know, your primary role. You have to make sure your clients, you know, what you're doing will help your client. So I would say I started thriving when I moved from, say, Frito-Lay or a manufacturing company to an agency where relationships were much more important than the numbers. And I started in the account side, but I moved into planning. I kind of slipped into it. I don't know how, because I found I had a real knack for reading between the lines. I had worked in a consulting firm before I started in advertising, and I would leave a meeting with three guys, and they would talk about what they heard, and I would say, "Yeah, but this person was looking at that person, and this person was, there's stuff happening in between the lines." So I found my, what I thought my like secret power was to know how to read people and figure out what they were saying behind what they were saying, or the meaning behind what they were saying. So the best professional kind of job I had probably was at Vocona Belding doing the director of Mind and Mood. I know you were there, which is a pseudo-ethnographic research program. So it's talking to people. No one, you know, people aren't asked a lot of questions about themselves. So they will open up if you ask them in the right way. And that was really joyous. I got a lot of you know, psychic benefits from that. But when the job got changed for a number of reasons, changes in the advertising world, and I got moved to a much, I wasn't doing what I wanted. I wasn't globally talking to people around the world anymore, and it became less fulfilling. All the time I was doing that, though, I had been thinking about writing and doing some writing. You mentioned, I'll say the high, US highs. Going and presenting to the marketing director at Samsung in Seoul, Korea, and having him yell at me for talking too fast, and then asking me to stay for another 2 days to present what I did to other people. You know, it was too fast,
but valuable information.
And being in people's homes in, not Dubai, I couldn't do that in Dubai, but China and Brazil and Singapore. And, you know, it's like an honor to be invited to these people's homes.
So for people that don't know about that kind of work, can you expand upon that a little bit more and explain how that work happens and then how it translates into advertising?
Right. So the easiest kind of way to talk about it is it's a focus group, but in someone's home. So, and it's with people that all know each other. So usually, probably many of your people have been involved with focus groups or know what they are. It's people who don't know each other, they're in a kind of clinical setting, and they're asked questions about what they think about a communication or what they think about a product, and they're asked for their opinions. This attempts to get you out of kind of the laboratory setting and into a setting that's comfortable for the people. So I'm coming in, it's not my home, it's not my safe space, it's their safe space. They know each other, and they're more likely to really open up. And we don't ask questions so much that they can give it a yes, no answer to. It's trying to really understand what motivates them, why they do what they do, not just what they do. Because people can report what they do. Often they report what they think you want to know. So there's a lot of projective techniques to get them to tell you things about their purchases and their habits. And then, you know, why do they do things and why do they fail to do what they want to do, et cetera. So the whole thing is then you work with the creative team to create a communication that links into these insights. Like this person is doing this because they, I can't think of a great example, but it's, you know, like people clean not because they want to clean houses, because their mother-in-law is coming over and they want, you know, people to know, they should, they want anyone to yell mother-in-law to think poorly of them. That's a bad example, but it's.
No, that's a good example. So the creative might show that, you know, I mean, that's a literal example, but it might show something like that where somebody's coming over and, oh my gosh, I got to get my house clean.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, how does it make me proud? Or, you know, we understood Oreos in Brazil. I think it was South America, they didn't like them because they made your teeth brown, you know, like Oreo cookies, not a clean cookie. And that was interesting. And in China, they don't drink milk. Well, the whole Oreo campaign is dunk. So you know, it wasn't like something that Mona Lisa thought of right away. And they're like, oh yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And they were involving, well, I won't get into that story, but that's the insights. Help the communication. So, you know, I'm looking at an advertisement. I go, they see me.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to buy it.
I like this company for what they're doing. So that was, you know, that's creating links and looking at a puzzle and coming out with the right answer. That kind of work was really exciting.
Yeah.
But I had, after I left Dallas, I came back to Chicago. Dallas was Frito-Lay. And I told myself I was going to get involved with something creative, that I just felt like my creative soul had died in Texas. And I took classes at Second City. And I loved the improv classes. I performed with a group while I was consulting. I remember getting paid $50 one night, you know, dank bar somewhere. And I thought, hey, you know, we each made $5 tonight. You know, that was more exciting than, you know, whatever I was working on at the office.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I was in a good space that I thought I could do something with this. And I, you know, I look back and I go, what was it about me then that said, go ahead and try, put yourself out there.
Yeah.
Years later, I would be, no, I can't do that. I don't have the credentials. I can't do that. But back after the Second City days, I was like, yes, I should be on television. I should replace Andy Rooney. I should do this. And I just, like, without thinking it through, which is, I think, how things happen, I just, you know, asked people. I hired a publicist and I got the column for the Tribune.
Yeah.
I used to describe, so that column was business humor, workplace humor. I called it the Irma Bombeck of the workplace. A lot of people don't know Irma Bombeck, but she wrote about the, you know, suburban life with humor and pathos, and, you know, made a lot of women around the country go, oh, I'm seen, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I used to describe that as my psychic benefit job and the advertising as my health benefit job.
So
I think benefits too, but
the timeline on this, when did you have the column versus 90. Your corporate career? Like, where, what were you doing in your corporate career when you had the column?
I just started working at Book Cone, so it was 96.
Okay.
So, you know, 12 years into my professional career.
Got it.
And I remember I had interviewed with Book Cone and with another agency, and I was trying to explain about my writing, because I had was doing some things with Marketplace Radio, and I wanted a four-day work week, and I wanted to know, even though I know I'd probably work more than 4 days, but I could take time off if I wanted to, because I wanted to be able to write. And I remember the other agency like going, well, I don't think that's going to work.
No. You're like, okay, then I think this is not going to work. So there you go.
And then Book Cone was like, that's fabulous. That makes you an interesting person.
That's right. Good for them.
You got to find the right company. This is a mistake. I used the analogy of a baby. Now, I don't have children, but I said, this is like my baby. You know, I want to stay with it. Well, that's not going to go over. but someone at Book Cone said, I think that's great.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And yeah, when you do have a creative passion like that, you do need space for it. Like, you have to make space in your head to be able to produce that kind of content. In addition to having, you know, I mean, working at Foot Cone and Belding as a global advertising executive is no small shakes. Yeah. So
that lasted just 2 years. But one day they called me, the Tribune, and said, we're dropping your column. I went, well,
okay,
fine. And I did try and get it syndicated and didn't have any luck. And there were a lot of personal things probably going on in my life at that time. And I just, let go.
So as many of us have experienced, you were laid off in 2010. And that sent you on a journey that I found most interesting for the work that I do. And when I talk to my clients, of going about a search for identity and purpose. And that story is amazing. So in your one woman show, you tell about going to the Moore Reinvention Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I vaguely had a memory of, like, being aware of this thing and that this was happening, and this group of women were getting together, and, like, Moore Magazine was kind of leading the charge with realizing that women, you know, were needing to reinvent at certain points in their career. I want you to tell us all about that.
Well, you know, Moore Magazine came out for the women over 40. I mean, that was like their tagline, which later they changed to something that didn't have an age on it. But, and I was laid off in 2008. And then
for
years I went to a writing program and did some consulting. But in 2010, I found out about this and I thought, okay, I'm going to go. And I didn't tell anybody because I was embarrassed that I couldn't figure it out myself.
Well,
so I don't know. I know there are a lot of things that I just didn't tell people because I was embarrassed. And nobody else that I knew was, like, in this crisis, you know,
Well, that you knew of.
That I knew of, yeah.
Yeah.
So I went, and I went really to see this one woman who was a reinvention coach, Pamela Mitchell. She still works. And because the other stuff, I just wasn't that interested in. I don't know what it was. I wasn't going there to learn how to do new makeup or whatever, but I wanted to see her. And it's interesting because they had Dana Delaney was speaking before, and Dana Torres, the swimmer who came back.
Oh, yeah.
When she was 40 or something. So they had, you know, some interesting speakers. And I sat in Coach Pamela, her session. And she went through, she had written a book, The 10 Rules of Reinvention. And one of them was, sometimes people don't like it when you try and reinvent. Because it brings up their fears and their worries.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that point, I was like, okay, fine. You know, I'll get her book. I'll do it on my own.
Yeah.
But my husband the night before had said, if you go back to school, because I thought I'll go back and get my MFA because I like school and I'm good at it. So
it's your safe space.
And so he said, I'm worried that, you know, we won't see each other, that'll change our whole life. Yeah. And at that point I went, oh my God. She's talking about what just happened in my house. Like, Paul's worried, and I have to deal with that while I'm scared to death about trying something new. And that is what made me say, okay, she gets me. I need someone who gets me. And I know myself. I'll just keep going to conferences and not telling people. I need to put some skin in the game. And signed up with her. And this wasn't in my show, but... Pamela had just been married 5 years. I'd just been married, I don't know, 6 or 7. But we were both married later in life for the first time. And I was telling her the story I just told you. And she said, oh, being with someone else in your house is difficult. And, you know, you heard the thing about, you know, sometimes my husband calls me just to say I'm coming home. And I'm like, why are you calling me? Just come home.
That's
so commiserated about this whole thing about, you know, trying to figure out what you want to do with your life and our husbands. And I was like, oh, this is fabulous. So I had the right person.
Okay.
And the conceit of my show is that I spent 9 years with her, 8 years with her. And I did, but it wasn't like every month, every week, you know, doing something. And towards, I'd say like the last, we worked really closely the first 2 years. And then the other ones were more of her checking in with me on my plans and my progress and, that
little thing. Accountability sessions.
Yeah, accountability. The first ones, we did a lot of exercises and mm-hmm. things. And all I have to say about that is if you do the work the first time, you don't have to keep doing it for years and years. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know what I would go through these exercises and I would dutifully do them because I'm good with school, but I didn't execute.
So
she stuck with me and got me to execute. And the biggest thing she pointed out to me, I would say two big things I learned from her. I don't know if you want to know this, but one is I always wanted to know what was going to happen before I tried. And she said, you can't know beforehand. And I said, but, you know, maybe I shouldn't do it. And the other thing was to really don't walk down the road with blinders on because you're following a path. But you may end up seeing something over here and you will be able to figure out if that's the next shiny thing or it's something you should go do. So it's kind of the second city, yes, and like, okay, I wasn't thinking I was going to do this. This wasn't anything I thought I'd get into, but okay, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And for me in my stage in my life and when I was working there, I realized I wasn't looking for a job. I
9-to-5 situation.
Yeah. It was going to be hard to get that anyway in the media and especially at the age I was. But I never wanted to be a freelancer. That just scares me. You know, that have been finding another job, finding another place to write, blah, blah, blah. But that's what I am.
Yeah.
And I had to come to grips with that. Luckily, I didn't need to make a salary like I had before. And I had health insurance through my husband until he retired. And then luckily we had the American Care Act. And then, now that is something I don't say in the play, but it is true. I had enough of a cushion that it wasn't like I needed to
make
money for groceries. But those are the things she got me. She just kept, I always say, Julie, you just can't know what's going to happen. You have to give that up.
I wonder how many times she said that.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's funny. She would just laugh and laugh.
So you've tried and experimented with a lot of things along this journey. Tell us about some of those things and how it kind of led you back to writing for a documentary film and then also doing a lot of theater that you're doing now.
Yeah. Well, the documentary is it's an interesting step because Pamela's like, look what the universe is giving you. I tried to start a podcast with a couple other women after the 2016 election to help women understand policy and, you know, talking from a bipartisan point of view, but this is what it means when you have this and that.
Yeah.
That didn't happen, but I met a woman who was going to be the producer, and she decided to do this documentary film and called me and said, I need a writer. You're a writer, right? And I did say, well, I haven't written for film. Like, you know, that's like a real talent. And then in the back of my head, in like 2 seconds, it went, I used to interview and videotape people about what kind of soap they wanted to use or, you know, why they thought they had to eat healthy and make a story out of it. So I certainly can interview people and make a story. And that's not such a big leap.
Yeah.
And so I said, yes. Which shocked the hell out of me and led to, you know, a very rewarding and interesting experience. I know I don't think I would ever work on a documentary film unless I had the same passion for the topic as the producer and the director. I think that's something that's really important to do that. I know I don't know everything there is to do about writing a film, but I've learned a lot. I am interested and, you know, I keep talking to people here and there about perhaps getting, you know, involved, but I haven't pursued that solely. And I did that. It's just like a lot of little things have happened. And while that was happening, I was pursuing trying to go work at Second City and they were doing focus groups on stage, basically, and setting up a program where they used the Second City actors to, you know, do a scene and get consumers to feed, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that didn't work out. But there were, I mean, I presented some ideas for a, I guess you call it a show for NPR on working women. My idea that is not yet done, and please take it and make it happen, is to do a podcast called 20-40-60 and an intergenerational conversation with women.
Ooh.
I'll be in my 70s soon. So, well, not that soon, but, and I, you know, it's like, I know it would work. I just didn't know how to do it. And I still don't know how to do it. You just started, I should just talk to you.
Well, you just have to start. It's the same thing where you don't know what's going to happen. You just do it. That's what I've done with this podcast. But that sounds really interesting because intergenerational collaboration is a really hot topic. And I think it's really important as well for both sides.
Right. Definitely.
Yeah.
So I've always had a lot of ideas. Working with Pamela, one of the last things we did together was like work out, you know, I had five things in my life. I was going to try and produce things. I was going to try and, I don't know, just like different things. And education, blah, blah, blah. And I identified five different writing classes and / instructors that I wanted to work with. And one woman, Arlene Malinowski, who works out of the Chicago Dramatist, and she does a solo storytelling. Because I realized when I was doing writing for the Tribune and doing Marketplace Radio, I really preferred speaking my words. It's just, I write like I speak.
Yeah.
So I wanted to to do that. The class started April of 2020. So, and at that point, I had already put together an outline of a book about my life experiences, which I, you know, you really have to be somebody famous to sell a memoir, or have, you already have a platform, you know, like I have, I'm a teacher at Harvard. And so, of course,
right,
I want to write my book, or I am a global marketing executive, which I wasn't anymore. You know, there's,
right,
that was fine. I mean, I was okay with not doing that. I did. I went to the Irma Bombeck Writers Workshop once and got won an award for the best pitch and a book pitch. And so I worked for 2 years on trying to get this book done, and I didn't get published, but I felt like, well, I'd done a lot of work and I felt good about that. So I,
yeah,
over the course of the pandemic and another year, I put this show together. So there's no, I don't, you know, there's no set reason for why I do these things, but Pamela did help me figure out how to identify the certain areas in my life and how to make a plan and, you know, act on them. It takes a lot longer, you know, nothing's going to happen fast.
Nothing happens fast.
And writing the show, people have asked me, what are you going to do with it next? And I said, I don't know. I don't know if I ever need to perform it again.
Yeah.
I felt like I did it. It's what I wanted to do.
But it was huge. I mean, you were on the stage telling your story for an hour,
yeah,
if not more. And
15 minutes. I think that's the best thing I've done for my brain.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly. But, you know, that was no small feat. And so that must have felt really good to just having accomplished that on a stage in a packed house in front of, you know, lots of people.
Friends and family come out. Yes.
Well, you know, but it was significant.
It's a very big deal. And there were things that I revealed that no one knew.
Yeah.
And
I didn't know some things. Oh, and full disclosure, Julie and I do know each other personally.
You know me as a director of Mind and Mood.
That's right.
And there are things that my husband didn't want me to talk about. I mean, it was, you know, about your life. And the story didn't make sense unless some of those pieces were in there.
Yeah. Well, and I think that kind of vulnerability is not only good for a solo show, but good in general as you're, you know, exploring new things and creating the life that you want to create. So, yeah, applause all the way around.
You have to be open. And I think perhaps maybe I was too vulnerable when I was in my business roles because everyone seemed to have such confidence. And I was like, is everybody like, why am I so different? I'm questioning myself. But yes, vulnerability is so important. I'm sure you've read Brené Brown. Yeah. I just love what she writes about vulnerability and it's okay.
Yeah.
And share where you're. And, you know, I never asked her to ask a question in a meeting that showed didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, now I'm okay with that. It's like, I don't know who you're talking about. I don't know.
What's going on? I don't
know. I'm not trying to pretend to be anything that I'm not.
Yeah, I think if more people were like that, we'd all feel a heck of a lot better about our lives and what we're doing, right? I mean, you know, I can't change it. I know, like, I follow you on Facebook, so I know you have some things coming up, and I feel like something even happened this week. Like, tell me what you have on the near horizon.
I did two storytelling shows. So Chicago has what they call a live lit scene. Live literature, and it's usually off book. Sometimes people are reading. And so I did one out in Forest Park on Tuesday. And then yesterday, This Much Is True is the name of the storytelling group up in the north side of Chicago. So they're usually 8 to 10 minute stories.
Okay.
So what I'm doing now is taking some of the stories out of the show you saw and packaging them into 10 minute pieces. Or nice. There's a lot that I wrote that didn't get in there because it didn't fit, and taking them and shaping them in to do on stage.
Nice.
So that's right now where I am. So I've got a lot of material and trying to figure out where it is. And then I'm submitting it to different places. Like I was fast fast fallen and fast famous. I met a woman at the Irma Bombeck Writers Workshop who's a gender and women's and literature professor at University of Connecticut, and she's put together these anthologies of fast, blank women, funny, fallen, whatever.
Yeah.
So submitting and getting published in those. So that's really wonderful. So I'm looking for more. I think I said when I first met Pamela, I don't want to just be the person that writes and submits and doesn't get published. And she goes, you'll never know if you're going to get published unless you submit. And I have accepted that fact. So I'm finding places to, you know, online journals and printed journals and anthologies like that. So that's, I've got a lot of material and I just need to get it out there.
That's nice. That's forming your legacy in the world.
Which is, that's the whole goal. Yeah. And that's, I think, what everybody's trying to figure out what to do, you know, with their legacy. What is it?
Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Another random and little known fact about you is that you were actually the Consul General of Liechtenstein in Chicago. And when I knew you years ago, your husband held this position.
Yes.
And I went to a couple fancy parties. It was very fun. But tell me about what that role is and what you're doing.
Well, it's an honorary role, which means I'm unpaid citizen diplomat, I guess, is the way people are talking about it now. So consul generals are usually State Department or whatever the country, their State Department employees. So Liechtenstein is one of the smallest countries in the world.
Yeah.
38,000 people. You probably have more people than that listen to this. And my husband had been approached years ago when Liechtenstein had just opened their embassy in D.C., which was probably 15 years ago. And they were looking for some honorary consuls. Many, many countries have them. And in this, there's 80 consuls and consulates in Chicago, and about 30 of them are honorary. So it's just, you know, if you don't have enough reason to fund a whole office. And Liechtenstein was honestly trying to let people know that they were more than a place that had numbered checking accounts like Switzerland did. So my husband had a reason for them to approach him. They knew of him from some past law case he had, but he had to find a replacement because he aged out, and there I was. And to tell you the truth, I'd done the job for 10 years.
Of course you had.
So the ambassador's like, well, we've never just had another family member. I said, so it's I call it a public relations job.
Okay.
The goal is to increase Liechtenstein's presence in the cultural, economic, political, business world as they want. So it's most of my work with them is if they come to Chicago or they're coming to DC. I'm an honorary consul of the Midwest. So Liechtenstein has a big company in Terre Haute, Indiana, and some companies in Michigan. They do a lot of things for cars.
Okay.
So I will accompany them to their offices and talk to about, you know, what these companies need or want. They send students over and I'll arrange tours here, take them to the theater, to the CSO, to the Art Institute. So I have most of my connections in town are cultural and education.
Yeah.
So we'll DePaul has a applied diplomacy undergrad degree. Like, where was that when I was a kid? So we've done speeches there. So it's whatever they feel the need, what they want out of the Chicago region. Generally, there's, like I said, 80 consulates here, and there is like a birthday party for a country every week, it seems. So I go to all the consulate gatherings. We had a meeting just last week with the people who are putting on the Democratic National Convention to understand what it means for security, for, you know, opportunities for consuls to attend. There are very little, very few. It's usually the ambassador that gets to attend, and the ambassador's in D.C. We meet with the state of Illinois once a month for, you know, talk about different topics. We'll probably end up being go down to Springfield to understand how legislation is done. A consul general's job is to represent the country in this region and take care of any visa issues. There's business interests, like the Swiss consul general. There's a lot of Swiss companies around, so they do a lot of trade work. Liechtenstein cedes all that work to Switzerland. Oh. So you don't need a visa to get to Liechtenstein. And, so that kind of diplomatic work we don't need to do. So yeah. I consider it me showing up at the meetings with other countries and being, there and letting them know Liechtenstein is something, we're around.
Yeah.
And we have meetings with the mayor and Chicago sister cities and things like that. So,
well, this is cool. I mean, this is like more substantial than I thought it was. I mean, it's taking up, a chunk of your time. Like that's.
Yeah, it can be, some months there's not much happening. And then sometimes like if the foreign minister comes in, it's a full-time job.
Wow.
It's planning 2 days of an agenda, her speaking and, trying to find professors that will let us into her class, let us into their classes and stuff. So,
yeah.
Yeah, you came to the concert, didn't you?
The concert, and then there was something else years ago. I can't remember. There was wine involved.
That was the biggest thing. That was her 300th anniversary, 300th birthday, and we put
yeah.
On. Yeah. That was
fun.
That was a lesson in theatrical production.
So, yeah, that was a production. Yeah. Well done, by the way, too. Julie, this has been really great. I've enjoyed this conversation, and I think there's been a lot of value here for my listeners. One final question is if you have any advice for people who are approaching retirement and searching for what's next in their third act.
Well, don't think it has to happen immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Give yourself time. Can I have two more things? What you light on first might not be the right thing.
Yep.
And just say yes.
Yeah. I think saying yes is important. Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was so fun to see you at my show and to connect again. You're lovely in all all the ways.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good weekend.
This podcast is sponsored by Good Morning Freedom, my retirement coaching firm. I help executives and professionals plan the non-financial part of their retirement, like how to discover new purpose and how you want to spend your time. I offer a one-on-one coaching retirement blueprint package where we work together to discover some new avenues of exploration for your Act 3. This coaching is completely custom and will provide you with a ton of resources and support as you transition to this new stage of life. For all the details, please go to goodmorningfreedom.com/services.